getting Julian Assange, The Untold Story, which is an epic piece that was written by John Pilger. You can actually get it at johnpilger.com. May 20th, 3,141 words. It is really comprehensive, and it's illuminating. Julian Assange, John, said that by far the most accurate write-up of my victory by multi-award-winning investigative journalist John Pilger. So I want to start with the Swedish prosecutor, Marian Nye. You take it from there. You actually said she should be prosecuted, which I gather you didn't say it in a hyperbole way. So why don't you just give us the background of her entrance into this after Eva Finn dismissed the case?
Well, after Eva Finn, the chief prosecutor in Stockholm, had found that Julian hadn't committed any crime, and she dismissed it. And that was meant to be the end of the matter. And then Marianne Nye. Marianne Nye, or Nye, I'm not sure which, was a close friend, a close political friend and personal friend of a politician called Klaus Borgström. Klaus Borgström was a leading and very contentious light in the Social Democratic Party, which was then running in the Swedish elections. Borgström, I have to say, Borgström presented himself as, seems extraordinary, but he did, as an extreme feminist. And it would probably be fair to describe Marianne Nye as, if not an extreme feminist, then certainly one who was a radical in the sense of being uncompromising in many of her pronouncements. So there was this political relationship between the pair of them. Marianne Nye was in Gothenburg, and so there was no real reason why she should be taking the case anyway. Borgström picked her out, she became the prosecutor, and she said the case was reopened. Now, at one of the early press conferences, Borgström, who is a lawyer and then offered to represent the two women in this new phase of the pursuit of Julian Assange, Borgström was asked at a press conference by a Swedish reporter who put it to him, look, the women say, deny they were raped, then what's all this about? And Borgström said, waha, but they're not lawyers, are they? And it was with that kind of Machiavellian tone that this whole sinister saga began. And here we are almost 7 years later, with Marianne Nye having not done what she was meant to do under Swedish law, and that is question a suspect. Julian had been arrested on August the 30th, 2010, in Stockholm. He waited in Sweden for 5 weeks to be questioned by the prosecutor. He was never charged. To be questioned by the prosecutor. That's what was her job. She didn't. He asked permission, or rather his lawyer asked permission, if he could leave Sweden because he was due in London to oversee the publication of the Iraqi war logs in The Guardian.
Right.
He was told he could leave, and he left. And then in November of that year, out of the blue, a European extradition warrant was served on him with an Interpol red alert attached to it, the sort of thing that's reserved for terrorists and dangerous gangsters. He presented himself at a police station in London, was duly arrested on behalf of the Swedes, and put in prison in solitary confinement for a week. Then he was released on £340,000 bail. You know.
Wow. And he had to wear an ankle bracelet as well?
And he had to wear an ankle bracelet.
I see.
He was then tagged with an ankle bracelet. So he was effectively imprisoned. He was not only that, he was... There was a time limit on the time he could spend away from where he was then staying outside London. There was a lockdown. He couldn't be out at night. In other words, he had to report to the local police station every day. So he was treated like a very dangerous criminal. And he hadn't been charged with anything. And he hadn't been questioned about anything.
But he agreed to be interviewed by Scotland Yard, or in Scotland Yard. He asked Nye to come in and interview him there.
Yes, yes. It's standard procedure in Europe that for people who are arrested, particularly under this European arrest warrant, which, by the way, is no more. The British Parliament voted to get rid of it in 2014 because it was just being used as a catch-all. You couldn't defend yourself. People who'd committed virtually no crimes or minor crimes, it was being used in domestic matters. It's now gone. So all this wouldn't have happened had it been a few years later. But Scotland Yard had a special video room, has a special video room where police in other countries in a secure setting can interview people over crimes or over for whatever reason. And this was offered to the Swedes. And in fact, the Swedes, I calculated, have used it 44 times in other cases since Julian was arrested. They refused to use it with him. When he did go into the Ecuadorian embassy, the Ecuadorians offered the facility of the embassy. He offered himself to go to the Swedish embassy in London. So there was full cooperation here being offered. And remember, he had been in Sweden for 5 weeks waiting to be interviewed and wasn't interviewed.
Wow.
Now, I think there's a prima facie case of obstruction of justice here. And that's why I wrote that I believe that the Swedish prosecutor should be prosecuted.
Well, I think...
I doubt whether she will be, but I think she should be.
Ex-Swedish prosecutor Rolf Hilgren said that Nye has lost all impartiality. And then you have Al Burke from the Nordic News Network said that the Swedes submitted to U.S. pressure. I want to ask you about this Pentagon secret document that was prepared called Cyber Intelligence Assessment Branch and their plan to discredit WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. Give us the background on that and this document.
Well, that was 2008. And that document, which... was leaked to WikiLeaks, is about WikiLeaks. And it foretells or outlines everything that was to happen. And there was a plan in place to discredit, the words they used, to discredit WikiLeaks, to smear Assange, to take away the trust that people invested in any source of information, and in other words, to destroy the reputation both of WikiLeaks and of Julian Assange himself. That was clearly set out in this document.
This is a preemptive attack then?
This preempts it. 2008 goes right back.
So they want to discredit him before all of this material, this exposure of U.S.
Well, he was already releasing material, but it wasn't, WikiLeaks didn't have the reputation it was soon to have.
Right, after the dump in 2000 of the, so I don't know where it came from, but
The
war logs.
Chelsea Manning it was really the release which Chelsea Manning undoubtedly released of the collateral murder video, which showed an Apache helicopter, U.S. Apache helicopter, gunning down people in the street, including children and journalists.
That's in a, you can see that
in Iraq. In Baghdad.
Baghdad, right. That's in your documentary, The War You Don't See, which you can get at John Pilger.
That's easily available. It's on the net. You can see it. That's really, and that was a visual version of the so-called then Iraqi war logs, which really describe the kind of homicidal nature of the American military intervention in Iraq, numbers of civilians killed, how they were killed, the homicidal sense of the military, and the atrocities and so on.
Right.
The lies. It showed how the U.S. had lied.
Snowden says that. Go ahead.
Go on.
I was just going to say, Ed Snowden said that because of this, that he actually is on a manhunt. He's a manhunt target, Julian Assange, and that really has sparked him to go into the Ecuadorian embassy. If he hadn't gone into the Ecuadorian embassy, what do you speculate would have happened?
Well, he challenged and appealed against the European arrest warrant extradition order, and it worked its way right through the British courts, right up to the UK Supreme Court. And what was made clear was that this extradition order, this European arrest warrant, was so draconian, so catch-all, it was almost impossible to challenge, almost impossible to defend yourself against it. So by the time he got to his case got to the Supreme Court, and it was made reasonably clear, I think, by judges along the way, that they felt their hands were tied by the terms of this treaty, this extradition treaty. There was nowhere else to go, and there was a real fear then that the U.S. would, at the end of this process, apply to the UK courts for Julian's extradition to the United States.
And
his lawyer, Gareth Evans,
right,
who's an authority on this, the way the U.S. has coordinated its extradition requests with other legal matters. So she was very concerned that at the end of this long process, the U.S. would move in. And at that point Julian decided to seek asylum, which of course he'd already made some arrangements, contingency arrangements for, in the embassy of Ecuador.
You back then, I don't know, it was in 2010, 2011, spoke to Malcolm Turnbull, the prime minister, when he was a member of parliament. And what did he say to you, and what did he do to help out?
Well, you see, Julian's own country, Australia, which is, of course, my country as well, one of the reasons that Ecuador was able to make Julian a political refugee was the abandonment of him by his own country. His lawyer here, Gareth Evans, warned the Australian foreign minister that Julian, Australian citizen, was in grave danger of suffering a great injustice, and not only just an injustice, but was in physical danger, mortal danger as well. And I delivered her letter to Malcolm Turnbull, who was then, he's a lawyer, he had something of a reputation as an advocate of libertarian issues, and he'd been a lawyer in a famous case in which he defended, he appeared for the defense. He is a politician, and I asked him to use his influence to take her letter to the Foreign Minister of Australia and to alert the government to the dangers that Julian faced. He didn't do anything. That's very clear. Turnbull is now the Prime Minister.
Right. But Julian,
I mentioned that because it was that kind of inaction, indifference, if you like, in his own country that led to Ecuador granting him refugee status.
The same with the Australian High Commissioner, Commission Minister in London, Ken Paco, who was of no help as well to one of his citizens, Julian Assange.
Finally, in Gareth Pearce's offices in London, came the Australian Consul General Paco and his assistant. He didn't know anything about the case. I mean, it was quite shocking to
what he read in the newspapers.
He said he only knew what he read in the newspapers. Julian was deserted,
right,
by those who, by law, should have been offering him protection, that is, the representatives of his own government.
Here's one that really bothers me, is that the Prime Minister back then, Julia Gillard, threatened to take his passport away.
That's right. She threatened to take his passport away. So eager was Julia Gillard to please the United States. This is a Prime Minister who made one of the most fawning speeches in front of the Congress. She was so eager to please the United States that she said, I won't take his passport away. And it was the Australian Federal Police so she sent them off to investigate Julian. They came back and said, well, he hasn't done anything wrong. He hasn't committed any crime. And anyway, you can't take his passport away.
That's amazing, just amazing. You know, I now that he has been relieved of these charges or allegations, they're not even charges, allegations in the air by the Swedish prosecutor, the Metropolitan Police have a warrant for him for skipping bail. Now, Craig Murray said the other day that there are tens of thousands of Brits who are walking the streets of England who have skipped bail, that, you know, they don't have guards outside their houses.
That's right. Well, I think the numbers of people all over the world who've skipped bail would be a very considerable number. He skipped bail, and the embassy was for something like, I don't know, 5 years at the very least, surrounded as if it was a stakeout, with police in the footpath and police van opposite. And this, of course, became a media story that the British taxpayer was paying for all these police to be there. They didn't blame the police, they blamed Julian. So it was the victim was to fault here, and the police, who were mounting this entirely theatric, unnecessary siege, were merely doing their duty. Well, that didn't go anywhere, and the police then decided they would withdraw, which they did, and it made no difference. Julian wasn't going anywhere. There may have been one police officer outside the embassy, as there is outside all the embassies. But of course, the embassy is under blanket surveillance, and as we know from Edward Snowden and others these days, surveillance is something that can be pervasive.
I hope they're not surveilling this station or me, but I suspect we're all being surveilled. Now I want to go to the Guardian newspaper. So they gave, I got to get back to that. Maybe we'll switch it around. But the Guardian, Alan Rush Ridger, who published this stuff, didn't really come out and defend Julian after it was published by the Guardian. But they certainly used his material.
The Guardian did extremely well out of WikiLeaks. Alan Rusbridge, the editor then, he's no longer the editor, described it as the greatest scoop in 30 years. Thing was, it wasn't his scoop, it was WikiLeaks' scoop.
Right.
But they were certainly a partner with WikiLeaks in publishing it and editing it and presenting it, but it wasn't their scoop. He claimed it as their scoop. Well, that was one thing. Another thing was that The Guardian then deserted a Julian Assange. It's basically their source. He was the person who provided this scoop. The whole episode was really unsavory, where for a combination of reasons, some of them quite personal, Julian was discarded, if you like, by Guardian journalists. And the Guardian then started publishing articles critical of and abusive of the very person that had provided them with the greatest scoop in 30 years. It really was a disgraceful period. A book was published, a Guardian book, written by two journalists called Luke Harding and David Lee. And in this book, they gave away the password that right. Julian had given them. This password had previously ended up in the United States. They also abused Julian in the book. He became open he became open game. Every journalist, and I would think every second-rate journalist or third-rate journalist, could cut his or her teeth by having a crack at Julian, and in the most offensive and personal way. It reminded me of how the pillory used to work several hundred years ago, putting people in the stocks. Then the villagers would come around and abuse them and perhaps throw things at them. It was pretty much like that.
Right. Hunchback of Notre Dame. It's an awful period. Yeah. You call it anti-journalism. What is anti-journalism?
Well, it means it's anti-journalism, is against journalism. These are people with the pretension of being journalists, but in fact what they practice is anti-journalism. That is something that is contrary to real journalism.
I see. But
propaganda.
You would think that journalism, or journalists around the world, New York, London, whatever, would come to his defense, because by attacking him, attacking someone that is a publisher, if in fact he were to be prosecuted under the Espionage Act, they're basically setting themselves up for a similar fate.
Yeah, that's right. The war on whistleblowers, which really got underway with Barack Obama, is also a war on journalism. But the corporate institutions of journalism have been so embedded in the system for so long that their instinct is to protect and reinforce the system. I mean, for example, The Guardian handed on the Afghan warlogs, I'm not absolutely sure, they're to the New York Times. Well, the New York Times also published the Iraqi warlogs, but they only published them after they took them to the White House and had them cleared. That's become an instinct in corporate journalism. Since journalism became really part of a great corporation, then it's become simply a handmaiden for established power. There are honorable exceptions to this, quite a few of them, but generally speaking, that's the case.
The preponderance seemed to be...
And there's a great club of journalism. Julian Assange's crime was that he didn't want to belong to their club.
Right.
So they didn't like that.
Well, you two are great examples. You are really my favorite journalist, and he's my favorite publisher, and you guys are great role models. I know you only have a few minutes left here. I want to ask you about, you say that it's over, but the campaign against him it's not over. It's not over,
no,
but the campaign against him is unraveling.
Yeah, well, it has unraveled. They've got nothing to do now. They can, a few have tried throw away a few last smears, but once you take away the Swedish factor in this, then you've taken away a source of all kinds of smearing. So what's left? Well, what's left is that which any true journalist should support, and that is somebody who has published information that the public has a right to and which has been kept secret from people, they should support that whistleblower, that truth teller, and in Julian's case, he's a publisher of this material. Well, WikiLeaks receives leaks and publishes them. That's and is devoted to a transparency, the very transparency and freedom of speech that just about every politician in the United States keeps telling us, the rest of us in the world, is also unique about America.
What do you see, John, as a way out for him at this point?
The way out I see is a negotiation with the British government, because that's where it is at the moment. The British government and the US government in the shadow, of course. But he is in Britain. And so, you know, putting aside the really relatively trivial matter of whether the police are going to arrest him for bail infringement or not, it's a matter now for the British government. He is, as the United Nations has made very clear, a political refugee, and a political refugee in considerable danger. His case has been examined by a UN working group that is an authority on international law, and he has been found to be detained, as they put it, detained unlawfully. And so it is down to Britain to give him safe passage out of the embassy to a third country.
We're expecting Britain to recognize international law.
Recognize international law. Britain participated in the tribunal, the United Nations tribunal, that examined this case. It took part in it. It put its case. The tribunal made an unequivocal decision for Britain not to recognize this decision is like somebody going to court and saying, well, I'm sorry, the judge has gone against me. I will not recognize that. Well, that happens sometimes in political cases, but not in this. This is a government that has recognized the decision of this UN tribunal in the cases of Aung San Suu Kyi and others when they've examined people also unlawfully detained. So it's really down to the British government to do that. Now, they're masters in Washington.
Wow. They're one of our colonies now. We were one of your colonies. I said they're one of our colonies now. We once were one of their colonies, but they certainly act like a vassal state, as does Australia. Yeah. John, we got to close up here in a minute. I want to say something about your new movie, which is coming out now, is out at bullfrogfilms.com. You can get The Coming War on China, which I believe is now in China. It's been translated into Chinese, so the Chinese get to see what's happening around their country. This is a great documentary. It's monumental, and I'm so pleased that it is now gone around the world, including China.
Thank you, Randy. Yeah.
And we wish... When are you going to be in New York, John?
Later in the year, I'll come and see you.
I will probably see you. I'm going to come out for the June 19th 5-year anniversary if he hasn't been released by then, Julian Assange. I plan to pass through and do a radio show from London on June 19th.
Right.
If not, I'll see you in New York.
All right. Look forward to that very much.
Thank you very much. And
okay,
thank you for all the great work you've done over the years. Bye-bye.